from Los Angeles, California, from our house to your house. You're listening to Radio Suzy One on the World Wide Web, one of the web's oldest broadcast stations, broadcasting since 1996. And if you've been listening to the show, then you know when you listen to this show, you turn the lights down low. Here she is.
Hi. I'm Dr. Susan Block, your love doctor, your mother confessor, your ever so slightly twisted little sister, your daughter of the American Revelation, your horny housewife, your pleasure preacher, brothers and sisters, lovers, and sinners. And we are all sinners. Some of us are saints, of course, in addition to being sinners. And we are coming up on the holiday that celebrates Saint Valentine's Day. That's right, it's coming up on Hearts and Flowers time. Or maybe it's panties and dildos time for you. Whatever your fantasy or fetish, unless you live in an igloo with no internet in Antarctica, in which case you can't hear this show, you can't avoid dealing with your fantasies, fetishes, and feelings about romance around Valentine's Day. And just in case your love life isn't ideal, just remember, the ideal is the enemy of the real. And consider the fact that Valentine's Day is actually based on a fairy tale. The whole day, the day that celebrates Valentine's Day, is a commercial holiday that was actually pretty much created in the 19th century to sell cards. And that it did. And the people that created this holiday to sell cards, the business people, I guess, and the artists, they hooked up with this holiday of Valentine's Day that was kind of this Roman Catholic feast day that commemorates the martyrdom of an obscure saint, so obscure that there's, I think, several different Saint Valentines, and we're not sure which one it really is, that supposedly were martyred around, you know, early Roman times, early Christian times in Rome. And so they took this obscure holiday and then they created this story of a Christian martyr, Saint Valentine, who married couples illegally in pagan Rome. It was illegal because Emperor Julian had decided that soldiers who didn't get married were better soldiers somehow. I don't know if that's true, but this is just part of this myth. I don't even think that there was a law like that, although I'm not sure about that. Anyway, Saint Valentine secretly married couples in his home, and I guess Christian weddings, and then he was arrested. And he was supposedly very wise and charming, and even charmed Emperor Julian, who would visit with him and try to convert him to paganism. And Valentine would try to convert Julian to Christianity. And, you know, I guess Julian won the contest. And Valentine was condemned to death and imprisoned. He healed the blind daughter of his jailer who fell in love with him. And before he was tortured and killed, he left the girl a farewell note signed, "Your Valentine." And then, of course, he was tortured and killed and made a martyr. And according to the myth that was created in the 19th century to sell cards and candy and diamonds, you know, flowers. Maybe the flower industry created it, I'm not sure. But one of those industries, or a few of them. And they said that, you know, after when Christianity took power and, you know, Valentine's Day became this holiday to commemorate this great saint, patron saint of lovers. And it is a great story, you know, the secret weddings and the romantic healing of the jailer's daughter and the farewell note signed, "Your Valentine." But it's a total myth. It was created in the 19th century along with the candy hearts, flowers, and diamond-ringed commercialization of this obscure saint feast day. So there you have it. Most of the great spiritual stories are myths. They're not real. The ideal is the enemy of the real. So you might not have a perfect love life. You might not have an ideal love life. Valentine's Day is a time to celebrate any kind of love in your life. Any kind of erotic pleasure. You know, like I always say, make love to someone you love on Valentine's Day. Even if that someone is you. But now that you know that the Valentine's Day story is really bogus, you know, you don't have to feel weird if your Valentine's situation is a little different. So speaking of spirituality, that is the subject we'll be talking about at Sex Week at Yale. This is our fourth Sex Week at Yale coming up. And we're going to be talking about sex, sexuality, and spirituality, sex and God. The old slogan is for Yale, for God, for country, and for Yale. So this will be for God, for sex, and for Yale. Okay, you sinners and Valentines. If you want to talk to me, and Brother Dave is also here. Hello, Brother Dave.
Good evening, Doctor.
How you doing?
I'm doing quite well, actually.
What did you think of the Valentine story?
I thought it was very interesting.
Did you know that story?
Sort of. I kind of knew that. It's probably
one of those things you kind of know.
Yeah.
Like Santa Claus, but not as specific.
Kind of invented by Hallmark cards, I guess.
Maybe Hallmark. Yeah, it was cards. Some kind of cards.
It was probably Hallmark.
And flowers.
Disney invented childhood.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as childhood before the 50s.
Not the way that
we
define
it now.
Right.
Yeah.
Not the way that it became this kind of Disneyland of play.
Of play.
Right.
You should do nothing as a child but play.
And study.
Well, but not even that when you're a real small child. You know, 9, 10, 11. 9, 10, 11 should be baking bread. You should be, you know, building buildings. You should, you know.
Right.
And religiously, religious-wise, religion-wise, what, confirmation for a Catholic boy is, I think, 12. They become a man.
Yeah, you know? And the bar mitzvah for a Jewish boy or girl is 12.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So those were the stages where you became, you went to work for the family.
Yeah.
You learned a trade, you became a person, a man, an adult, you know.
Well, I went to junior high, which was a lot of work.
Well, yeah, no, I understand.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, the way I took junior high.
Right, so. But it was all very nice, you know.
No, it wasn't all so nice either. No, not at all. No, it was pretty rough. In fact, sometimes I think I would it would have been easier for me if I, you know,
there were
had
no,
a, you know, just a trade or something.
Yeah, but I mean, you had guards at the corners, you know, protecting you and making sure that you could cross the street, you know.
Oh yeah.
Versus, hey kid, it's dangerous out there.
Right. Well, you know. What are you saying? We shouldn't have.
Well, no, I think you put.
I
think that you take away a lot of responsibility by, doing those kinds of things. That's all.
Hmm. How do we get up to that? Kids and
fairy tales.
Fairy tales.
Valentine, childhood. Ugh. I mean, childhood is a total fairy tale. It's a Disney invented kind of thing. They said your kids should not be working. They should be watching Disney movies and Disney television.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't have kids. That's one reason I don't, so I don't have to decide things like that.
Anyway.
You know, what my kids should be doing, because I don't have kids. You know, so I don't have a strong opinion about that.
It's interesting. When I went to buy the what do they call that thing? The showcase?
Yeah.
There was, it's owned by a Hispanic family, the company, and one of the sales managers is Korean, I think, or Japanese or something, but the company is Hispanic. So, you know, I went there and I looked at the different cases and so forth and so on, and then I went back the next day. There was a little girl there. She must have been no older than 12, 13.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I walked in and there was nobody else around. She comes over, she goes, "Good afternoon. Well, have you decided to buy the case? It's a good case."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you know what? She called to the back and got these guys to come out. She took the credit card. She ran the credit card. Gave me the receipt. You know? And watched as these guys put the case and told, "Be careful now. Turn it this way." And I was like, wow.
Hmm. Yeah, well, you know, that goes on in third world countries quite a bit.
While she was doing her homework.
Mm-hmm. It's a family business.
Yeah.
You know.
It's totally legal, by the way.
In the United States.
United States, right.
Yeah. But, yeah, I saw a lot of that when I was in Asia. I mean, I don't know. It's, I don't know what's best for people, really, in that regard. I mean, certainly... It doesn't seem to be harmful for a kid to be able to work in a family store.
Well, I went to work at 15. I had to make my own work.
You know, I really think that people tend to believe that whatever they had to do in childhood is the best for other children.
Probably.
That tends to be what it is.
But I can say this. This is probably the most educated era of the world where everybody's been to college and everybody has all kinds of degrees but nobody knows what to do.
Well, that describes me, certainly. That's definitely my personality. I have all these degrees and I never know what to do. I am constantly flying by the seat of my pants. And I
but you're doing
kind of enjoy
things.
That.
No, you're doing things.
I'm doing things, but I never know what to do.
I
it's
know,
true.
I know.
I'm doing things by sheer dint of the degrees and my skills. But knowing what to do, I think one of the things that, you know, a lot of education does is that it shows you all sides of stories, you know, so that you don't have these kind of black and white opinions, like children should work. You sort of say, well,
are you saying that's a black and white opinion?
Yeah, that's a black and white opinion.
No, I don't think so.
Children should work.
I really think it's good for kids.
Well, you just said that. That's right. You think it's good as opposed to bad. And I don't have a good, bad kind of opinion. I think some kids would thrive with it. I don't know. I think...
Well, that's just the point. And some would crumble under it.
Right.
But in
so
later
I
years...
So I happen to thrive in the academic environment. Right. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's good.
Okay.
I think that's good. But I think that the feat...
So...
You are
kind of decrying the academic environment
No. I think that defeat is the genesis of success, and I think that children should learn defeat at a very early age.
Well, I don't know.
I learned
defeat at an early age.
Yeah, I think that's important.
Well, it's depressing.
Well, it might be depressing. But
yeah.
It is all those...
I guess it's character building.
Yes, of course.
It's character building. But, I mean, you learn defeat at school easy. I learned defeat at school. I had little jobs and things. But I was middle class. I didn't have to have jobs.
Well, it's funny because at school I was terrible. Of course, it was my second language. I didn't speak English when I came here. But I shined in art, okay, and I shined in wood making.
Yeah.
And I shined in print.
Good
so,
for you.
There were defeats and there were triumphs, and my triumphs have carried me through life.
Well, that's true. There's always defeats and triumphs, and little humans grow up into big humans, whether they go to school or they go to work. You know, some of them will die and most of them will grow up and do things and have families and do things to their kids. So, you know, that's what happens. And whether they work or not, I mean, work is going to be good for some, school is better for others. They're individuals.
Well, but I think that today almost everybody is pushed towards this school and university, which not all kids can do. There's no more trade schools. There's no more apprenticeships.
You know, let me just say one thing. One of the reasons I didn't have children is so I didn't have to worry about this.
So you don't want to talk about it?
Well, not really. I mean, who the fuck cares what these kids are doing? I don't really care. Let them work or study or, you know. I mean, let them watch my show. That's
well,
what I
say. I just want to say...
Let them grow up and buy sex toys. I mean, I don't want to have much to do with them while they're that young. They're not allowed to buy sex toys. I could get arrested for even, like, hanging out with them because I'm such a sexual character. So what am I doing? Talking about whether they go to school or go to work. I don't want to be advocating them going to work. Next thing you know, they're going to think I'm advocating other things. So I'm sorry. No, I'm going to start asserting benefits of being child-free, okay? Because there's certainly enough, you know...
Less pollution.
There's a lot of grief that we child-free people are given. So let's just assert some of the benefits. And yes, of course, we create less pollution. I want a benefit that accrues to me for being child-free. Of course, one of them is that I don't need to worry about whether these people take their children and they put them through college or they put them in, you know, they lock them up in the closet or they do whatever they do to them. You know, that's their kids.
That's not going to change much anyway.
But not much, exactly.
One thing today about these kids, every parent I talk to has the most brilliant child in the world. When I grew up, you never heard that.
I was the most brilliant child
in
the world.
I know.
That's one reason I don't have children is because I wouldn't be able to bear having one that was not the most brilliant. And I would torture my child certainly as soon as I found out it was not it or he or she was not the most brilliant.
What do you think? You think kids should go to work or they should go to college? Or?
I said I don't care. Okay. I really... You know, that's up to you.
No, I'm just asking some people out there.
Well.
Okay, so forget the kids. They're a pain in the ass anyway. So.
Okay, so I was trying to talk about other things, but now I got completely derailed onto talking about the kindergarten.
Spirituality?
Spirituality?
How about that? I talked to a lawyer today that talked like that.
Yeah, I heard that lawyer. Yeah. Sounded like, what's her name? Vivian Hammer.
Stephen Friedland. Oh.
Stephen Friedland sounded, I know, well, let's not make fun of sissies now.
No, no, he's not a sissy.
How do you know?
He just has a
high voice. Sounded
like
one.
I said you, I said you're cute. He says, I didn't know you go that way. That counts.
I didn't know you go that way.
Get a voice. All right, anyway.
Well, people can have their different voices.
Yes, of course.
But his was very feminine, let's say. But
well,
not in a good way. Not in a... It was squeaky.
My fat...
Some people, some male, you know, natal males, have feminine voices, but they are very melodious and nice.
Well, that is a... You're not born with that. I had a totally different voice. And then when I became an actor, I had to learn how to walk and how to use my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And some people don't know how important voice is in the... in seduction and work and telephone.
Right. So voices. Yep. So voices. This was a very grating voice. But you know, he's like one of those kind of lawyers, so he probably wants to have a grating voice. He wants. You know, it scared me when I heard it this morning on the speakerphone. I heard that voice. I went ah.
So, Yale, we're going to Yale.
We're going to Yale.
Right, and...
And we're going to talk about sex and God with a former Jewish rock and roll journalist who is now a Catholic proponent of chastity.
We don't have to talk about her tonight. We gave her enough plugs, right?
I know, but, you know, it's good to have some...
And who else do we
foil.
Have?
Well, we have... Stevie J is his name, this guy.
That's the comedian.
That's the comedian, right.
Okay. Now, if you're anywhere around Yale and you want to, you know, come...
Come to the panel. I think the panel is open. So you can just go.
Right. Or if you just want to come there and take us to dinner.
Well...
Or drive us around.
Drive us around.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we could perhaps use a little... slave of some sort.
Correct.
Yep, we could. So, that's true. You know, Yale, of course, started out as an all-male, deeply Christian,
right,
virtually monastic institution, and the founders of Yale in 1701. Including famous Puritan Cotton Mather, founded Yale as a rebellion against what they perceived to be the growing liberalism of Harvard. So this was supposed to be an even more conservative place of congressionalist ministers. Yale was founded to be holier than Harvard. But its piety was intertwined with its rebellion against the older, more established institution. And, you know, rebelliousness is part of the spirit of
and,
sex.
And does Yale stand for something, the letters, or just Yale?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the guy that gave him the most money, gave these congressional ministers some money, was this... he was a businessman that he probably ran slave ships of some sort or something.
Or
was in the opium trade, I think. And it was Elihu Yale.
That's interesting because you know there's a very famous lock company called Yale.
Yeah.
And it's very old.
I don't know if they're related.
And it's been around for...
I don't know that Elihu Yale did anything else of worth.
Really?
Really, this was it. He donated... a bunch of books. It was like he gave maybe, you know, $500 or something like that. But this was in 1701.
So that was considerable.
So that got them going, and they decided to name their institution Yale because he was the biggest donor. You know, so they put their spirit where the money was coming from.
Well, maybe if we gave $500, we could get a building named after us.
I don't think you can get a pebble in the really? Sidewalk of Yale named for you with $500. I think.
Boy.
You need a lot more.
Hmm.
Although we have created Sex Week at Yale, which we can feel very
right.
involved with.
Very much a part of it. Counseling.
Right. Now sex and Yale go together, at least for a week.
Early stages.
The week. Sex Week at Yale. And so, you know, they've never had a Sunday event, so this is because they were always afraid of offending the church. And
well, this should be fairly offensive.
This should be, you know, I was thinking about how to do this. You know, I'm thinking, that's why I'm talking about it, because I got to figure out kind of how to get into this. I mean, how offensive should I be?
Well, irreverent. Not offensive, but I mean...
I wouldn't try to be offensive.
Chastity belt, you know. That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Chastity belt. Well, yeah. Do we should bring a chastity belt, I guess.
Well, we can just.
What other symbols of sex and God are there?
The cross.
The erotic angel.
The cross.
The cross is a symbol of sex and God.
Yeah, Victor makes some beautiful erotic angels. We sell them. And these are for the dead.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the cross is a symbol of sex and God together,
course,
but I don't know that everybody thinks that.
Really?
Well, no, I think not. I mean, most people don't think of the cross, the Christian cross, as being a sex symbol.
You know, I think that a lot of Catholics do.
Well, is that something you think I should talk about at Yale?
Well, I think that certainly being brought up as a Catholic, it's almost like the born-agains that when I was younger, when you saw Jesus on the cross, you almost went into...
You went into a swoon.
Into a swoon, and you kissed the cross. There was constant... The nuns are constantly kissing the cross.
Kissing the cross.
And this guy is bloodied. And he's not.
And he's half naked.
He's not
just
wearing
a loincloth. That's
a loincloth. And they're constantly. Jesus. Dio mio. Really?
Right. And it's in the shape of a dildo.
It's very, you know. Right.
What do you think about that? Do you think I should say that?
That might be offensive.
That might be offensive.
Yeah. But certainly.
But the shape, it's in a phallic shape. Can I say that?
The cross is certainly a phallic shape, yes. Uh-huh.
Phallic shape.
Yeah. It's a powerful, powerful image, especially with a naked guy and millions of women going around the world kissing it.
Yeah.
I mean, guys
kiss it too.
Yeah, I find that very strange. I could never understand that as a child. It was almost...
Well, it's not strange if you think of it as a sexual kind of, religious sexual fetish.
I told you the first time I went to Catholic school, right? They put my frock on, right? And the school was right. My grandmother used to live on Via Monte di Dio, the Avenue of God.
Yeah.
And the Catholic school was about 4 or 5 doors down. And so finally it was time for me to go to school. And, I was a pretty smart, rebellious kid. And... they put my little frock on, my black little frock on, and my, and I'd seen nuns all the time, you know.
Yeah.
But I never had close contact with them. And the school doors were like old wood doors in this very old building. And they opened up, so they took me there. And as soon as they opened those doors and brought me in there, I started fighting and kicking. And I stood there for about, could be maybe 4, 5, 6 seconds as these two nuns
yeah
were going to bring me into the school. And at lunchtime, I ran away.
Right.
Yep.
You did tell me about that.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was so horrified. I did not understand why these people were wearing black and white and scaring me.
Hmm.
I was virtually terrified. It was like a nightmare, Halloween.
It does seem to have had a profound effect upon you.
Absolutely. That stepping into that door changed my life.
Hmm. You were a happy boy until then.
I was a happy boy. I lived at my grandmother's, great-grandmother's house, which had vineyards and gardens right in the city, and beautiful terraces. And then I was forced to go there. And it did change me. I did not understand. Why are these people dressed like this? This is a fear campaign.
Uh-huh.
That's
fear.
All I felt.
But you didn't... Nothing was overtly sexual, of course, or anti-sexual.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that. I just thought that the costume, as they use them today, you know, for Halloween and for parties, had a symbol.
Scary. Black and white.
Black and white
scary.
Was about powerful colors.
Like,
you know,
skeleton.
And the church, you know, the
ghost.
Especially the Catholic Church, was a master at architecture.
Yeah.
And they were like Hitler. Hitler was a master of architecture. And so every church, it was this way for many, many years. Every church had to be built on a hill.
Mm.
Or a central place where you were constantly aware that they were there. And that was true in America, and it was true in Holland, and it was really true all over the world. And as modern church...
Well, you know, in and of itself, having a central spiritual house of worship, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
You know.
Have you ever been to the Vatican?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
If you're a non-believer and you walk into that place, the architecture, the grandness of it, puts you on your knees.
Well, I didn't get on my knees.
Well, no, I understand,
and
but you
I mean,
go,
I did not get on my knees.
People walk,
I just went, wow, that's really beautiful.
People walk around the Vatican going, wow.
Well, I just went, wow, when I went to the Taj Mahal. I mean, you know, I've gone, wow, for all kinds of beauty.
That's coming a long way from the stable that Jesus supposedly was born in, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of grandeur.
Yeah. Yeah, I got nothing against grandeur. I got nothing against stables, grandeur. What I have a little problem with is the way that most of these churches, Catholic Church, Protestant churches, Judaism to a lesser extent, but also Jewish temples, and Muslims as well, they have strong religious taboos against any kind of pleasure sex. And essentially there are two types of sex, if you will. You know, if you define sex, let's define sex, okay? Sex is touching that results in arousal. That's my definition of sex. What do you think of that? You could be touching yourself. You could be touching someone else. It's mostly touching physically, though it could be being touched in a sort of more mental way. And it results in arousal. So that's my definition of sex.
In Catholicism, it's also about looking at things. And during the Victorian age, of course, even table legs had to be covered.
Well, that would be a kind of touching of the mind.
Right.
So this could be intercourse or oral sex or kissing or cyber sex. I guess if you're just looking at something, no, maybe I wouldn't call that sex. I would only call it sex if you go home and masturbate about it.
No, thinking about sex in the Catholic Church
is
a sin.
Is a sin. I know. But let's just say this is what sex is. Now, that being given, there are two types of sex. Sex for recreation and sex for procreation. Sex for reproduction and sex for pleasure. And most of these religions, all of these religions, their main forbidden stuff, I mean, they scare you about all kinds of things. I mean, it's true. They're into the fear kind of mode of operation. But they really scare you about sex, masturbation, premarital sex, gay sex, bi sex, sex with your neighbor's wife, sex with your spouse when you're coveting or just thinking about your neighbor's wife, which could mean thinking about Angelina Jolie, because in the Global Village, Brad Pitt is your neighbor.
Yeah. Why do you think that the Catholic Church has collapsed and is collapsing?
Well, because
why
I think that the Catholic Church, to a great degree, is built upon the mythology and people, you know, I mean, it's tough to keep up that mythology, that idea that you're going to burn in hell if you don't do this, that, and pay the right people.
I mean, because in France, the Catholic country, in Italy, a Catholic country, in Holland, a very Catholic country, the churches have all collapsed. Nobody believes
it
anymore.
Well, yeah, but they have new frontiers. I mean, and there's going to be this Catholic woman convert at the Yale panel.
You know, I would like to know why such a great strength and such a great philosophy, why is it collapsing minute by minute?
Oh, well, one reason why is because it's just hopelessly outdated.
And unquestionable. You can't question it. Except
well,
from,
supposedly, right.
From the
can't,
Pope.
You're not supposed to question except the Pope.
Right.
And now we've got a really kind of mean, nasty Pope. We had a kind of warm, cuddly Pope before.
The German Pope.
Right. Now we have a German Pope.
Philosopher.
And so, you know, it's not that appealing. So people are going more to the other Christian sects as well as to Islam, you know. I mean... But hey,
but I also see
I'm not Catholic. I don't care.
I also see the great, I also see the great failure of Christianity here in this country, which George Bush was able to make people believe that it was an overwhelming force, and now you know even by their standards, it's that 20% factor.
Yeah.
You know, and most of these people have been discredited. All these evangelists, and you know, they've been caught with their thing in the thing.
Yeah. Well, because here's the thing, as we said. I mean, the ideal is...
The enemy.
Sex. Well, yeah, the ideal is the enemy of the real. And the ideal is that sex has to be confined to marriage only for procreation purposes, preferably in the missionary position with the lights off. And it's very hard to put sex into that little box. And some religions are a little easier on us, but still there's always an idea that sex outside the box is really bad. And, you know, a lot of people have an interest in sex, in pleasure, in love that is
now,
outside the box.
I find something very interesting about the Catholic Church, too. And in its collapse, they are like the cigarette companies. They are now going to third world countries to try and recruit.
Yeah.
Because they can't do it anymore even in the United States. They can't even get priests to become priests.
Yeah.
You know, but they are...
And they're even losing traction in Latin America.
Right,
so.
And certainly they're losing...
But they're big in Asia and China.
Right,
and,
right.
In Africa.
So they've gone to new markets.
That's what they're always doing.
Yeah.
That's what the Catholic Church is always doing.
It's a new
doing.
Market.
It's always about new markets, missionaries, you know.
You know, aside
so,
from the devastating...
And here's the other thing about the Catholic Church is, and this is also true of any really religious... Anytime you've got really strong taboos, you have people breaking the taboos and finding it really, really exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, it just like taboos make sex sexier.
Right.
They do. And that's why the Catholic schoolgirls are usually the dirtiest.
One of the things that the Catholic schoolgirls always represented was very these sexy plaid skirts that they used to wear.
Right.
That you're...
My dad made.
Your dad made.
Yeah.
They were very sexy. Everybody
They're very, very
those.
Sexy.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's not just, it's not confined to Catholic. I mean, when you look at a woman in a burqa, you know, and if she has pretty eyes.
Right.
It's like, Oh, so hot. You really, really want to know what's under there. And if you happen to see a picture of a woman taking off a burqa, it's like, wow, it's so much more erotic than seeing just a woman taking off jeans.
Hmm.
You know? It, the taboo does...
Well, if
that's how sex works. Sex is very kind of fluid. It's a fluid force. It always asserts itself. No matter how strong the power over it is, it asserts itself in some way, in some perverse way, you know, getting around whatever is decreed, you know, ideal, because the reality of sex is that it slips around the ideal, and it just takes all these different forms. Hello?
I'll be right back.
What?
I'll be back, right back.
Oh.
Go on.
Right back.
It's good.
Okay. It's good. Well, then we have the ideology of original sin, which was considered kind of cultish in Roman times when it came up. The ancient Romans believed that pleasures, whether gastronomical or erotic, should be indulged in moderation. And the odd cultish idea that sex was inherently bad was developed by St. Paul, who seems to have been fighting unwanted homosexual urges, and was cultivated by St. Augustine, who sought refuge in celibacy after a love affair gone sour. His wealthy mother disapproved of his low-class lover and made him miserable for it. So no wonder he abhorred lust.
By the way, I just want to say something. I'm not against Catholics.
No.
I'm against, like many Catholics, the structure and the oppression of the Catholic Church.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay, good. Good. So, something I was thinking about is that religion, in a very spiritual way, is losing somewhat of a hold on us, because...
You're being very kind when you say somewhat.
Well, because there is such a popular, you know, revival of religion right now in the United States, as well as around the world. There is.
I don't believe it for a second.
Well, but people are getting religion again. I mean, there's a resurgence of religious fervor in lots of different religions.
I've heard that for 60-some-odd years.
Well, I know, but now it's really
like
out there.
The
but I think it's very cosmetic, because I think that especially people just don't seem to really believe the mythologies. They're doing it for social reasons.
Catholic girls were fucking in the 30s. Catholic girls are fucking now. And now Catholic girls are also becoming porn stars. So they have made no headway. They have lost most of their power. And the only resurgence that I see and I hear are sort of these public relations, little sound bites.
Well, exactly. It's more or less, religion has become a social stepping stone. Like, you know, a way to connect with people and to say, to let people know that you're a moral person. That you go to church, or whatever you do.
But the churches are empty, Susan.
Well, but, you know, like the politicians all have to go to church, and everyone's arguing over whether, you know, Obama goes to mosque or goes to church. He's a Christian. Oh, he's Muslim. I mean, it's so important to people.
Because they want to keep that. You understand, in politics, you want to keep that edge. So you want to keep that. Let's say that you're not very religious, but you still go to church. You want to keep that percentile of religious people believing that you are a moral person. That's all that's about.
Well, and yeah. that's a big deal.
You think Billy Clinton really wants to go to church?
Well, I actually think he probably enjoys it. You know, the singing and stuff.
Oh, maybe that. But I mean, you know.
I mean, you know, it's enjoyable. And seeing the women and going in the back
listen,
with one of them, you know.
If you're the president, you got to go to church every Sunday. And you got so much crap to do. You know, that's a whole... That's, in fact, that's a waste.
But here's what I've been thinking. Most of the power of religion used to come from belief. I mean, people really believed you'd be going to hell if you masturbated.
Right.
They believed that. I don't think people believe that now. And, I mean, even if they are religious, I just really don't think that they might think masturbation's not good, but they don't think they're going to hell for it.
Well, wait a minute. Let's back up
a second. See, now people switch religions like they change jobs or locations, like this woman that, was Jewish a few minutes ago, and now she's Catholic, and there's a lot of changing of religions.
Well, now Starkey, or whatever his name is in France, the poodle.
Yeah.
He was Jewish.
Well, I guess a lot of Jews are always assimilating this part of it.
He was Jewish, and he decided for his career.
Yeah.
As a politician in France, he should become Catholic.
Now, that does not indicate a deep belief or faith in the mythology of the religion. The power of the religion lies in its social positioning.
Now, I also was brought, I go back to masturbation for a second. I never believed that, but I know a lot of the kids did, and as we talked about masturbating as we got to a certain age, about going to hell and all of that. But regardless of whether even the threat of hell and damnation
wasn't enough to stop them
in eternity.
But it could mortify them. You know, I believe that this is all healthy for sex, because now if your sexuality is demeaned by your religion because you masturbate or you're gay or, you know, whatever, I think you're less likely to be mortified than simply embarrassed. That is, you're less likely to be petrified about the state of your immortal soul than just worried about the respect of your family and peers. So it's less, debilitating, you know?
Yeah, I guess.
In fact, now some people actually choose a religion or a philosophy of life that complements their sexual desires. Some people do that. They choose churches that that support their sexual lifestyle.
That's good.
Or they come here to Eros
Listen,
Day.
I
people seek to have their spiritual needs met now very often in a way that supports their sexuality.
Right, I am not against that at all. What I'm against
is... Well, no, we actually, invite them to come here for Eros Day.
What I'm against is when they step out of that church and try to tell me and other people, when they become aggressive about it, when they put Jews in limbo and children in limbo, I mean, that's torture. Okay.
Well, it's funny. Can you have a church, can you have a temple that is really open-minded sexually? I think you can, too.
Yeah.
But somehow, those kind never get a lot of money.
Look,
why is that?
Well,
they never get a lot of money. It's always the anti-sex religions. I mean, let's say since Roman times.
Because, as Willem the Ritter would say, we still live in those times.
We still live in what times?
We still live in a Christian Judeo-ethic that has to be overthrown.
That is, we've been in since Roman times.
Roman times.
Because in Roman times there was a somewhat different ethic.
Mm-hmm.
There was an idea of moderation, but still that hedonism was okay.
Mm-hmm.
That you could,
so
have a good time.
We still, the power of that after...
sex was okay. And that different kinds of sex
Listen,
was
this
okay.
is, the major change has come here. Because of technology, book publishing, magazines. Once books were not the private ownership of the enlightened, once they spread, then everything started to change. And of course now the internet is reaching out everywhere.
There you go.
You know?
So, from the Gutenberg Bible
to
porn.
To porn.
Right.
Right.
Okay,
And the Bible was nothing more than porn.
Well.
Well, that's why everybody read it.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of sex in it.
There's a lot of sex in it. And there's slaying and there's...
Well, there's the slaying.
It's like television.
Yeah.
It's like modern television.
There's a lot of sex. There's the Song of Songs, which is very you know, kind of erotic poem.
But it's everywhere. They're lying
Adam
down.
And Eve, you know, they have sex.
They're lying down. And that's the only sex that was published for a long, long time.
Well, that's the only thing that was published.
Right. Yeah. The only thing. Right. Fortunately, today it's not the best-selling book anymore. So.
No, it's not, huh?
No, absolutely not.
What is?
Blogs.
Blogs? But blogs are not one book.
They're not one book, but they are one consciousness. And it is different opinions. It's not just the Bible. But probably today, in one day.
Yeah.
In one day, more people read blogs than have ever read the Bible in 2,000 years.
Cool. All right, well, read my blog, drsusanblock.com/blog.
Do we have anybody in the waiting room?
No.
No?
No, we've had people listening.
Right.
But, you know.
They're all gone?
Yeah. Well, no, we have some people listening, but aren't we about done?
Yeah, we're about done. Just to interact with, since we've taken over.
No, I know. We never even gave out the phone number.
We never even gave out. By the way, I listened to that woman, that doctor, what's her name, Sadie?
Oh, Dr. Sadie. Where'd you listen to her?
On an internet radio show. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they gave out the number every 2 seconds.
Every 2 seconds?
Literally, at least every 10, 20 seconds.
That's a little annoying.
And when a caller would call, they would go, "We have John." And it was kind of funny because they were having the same problems as we were having.
Ah.
But the woman is actually on a radio station in San Francisco. And she says, "We have a caller from so-and-so, and you have called."
And she gives out the number.
Yeah, 415, da-da-da-da. See, we're not very slick.
No.
We are really not slick.
1-866-289-7068 is our toll-free number if you're in North America. Anywhere else in the world, it's 213-749-1330.
Before we go, we don't have a jingle.
Jingle bells, jingle balls.
So
you're the singer. You're Italian.
You've got 8 minutes if you want to say something. We'd love to hear from you.
We have 8 minutes?
Yeah,
really?
From when we started, yes.
Oh.
Let's have some professionalism here. And
oh, you mean we have only gone 52 minutes?
52 minutes.
Ah.
Correct. That's correct.
Okay, then let's look at more of my ideas here.
And if you're there and listening on the internet, we urge you to call 213-749-1330. If you're in the waiting room, and you know what that is, then you can just put yourself in talking, and we'll talk to you. You have, if you have any comments or anything else you want to say.
You want to hear about some Bible rules against sex and the punishments? The stuff of Taliban dreams. If a woman touches a man's genitals, she gets her hand cut off.
This is what, the Bible?
Yeah. A woman who touches a man's genitals when he's not her husband or he's...
Boy,
if she touches them without his permission.
We got nothing over the Muslims.
She gets her hand cut off.
This is in the Bible.
And if a man is caught having sex with a sheep, both the man and the sheep are executed.
Why is the sheep executed?
Well, they feel the sheep was committed a sin.
Was part of it.
Yeah, the sheep was part of it. The sheep. So, sex and God.
That's a pretty angry God.
God is very angry in the Bible. I think in both the Old and New Testament. In the Old Testament, his anger shows great variety. In the New Testament, it's focused, you know, his son has to die in this horrible way. In the Old Testament, I mean, God is constantly jealous of other gods and mistrusting of the people. But, you know, there is a certain reality to that because when you think about it, you know, life is filled with tragedy and disaster, and I think it actually makes more sense to think of God as being a pretty much of a bastard than to think of God as being this good guy. I mean, obviously, if God were a good guy, Why would we be dying, even if we're good people? Why would babies die? Why would, you know, the bad people, you know, amass power? That's not a very good God. That makes no sense. So the later development of this idea of God being all good, I think, is really a mythology. But God being the nasty power that the Old and New Testament show him to be, well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to say there's only one God, then I guess he's got to be pretty much a schmuck, because life is pretty, you know, pretty tough. But it's also good, and there are these pleasures, and there are these sexual pleasures. And the God, the Judeo-Christian God, you know, pretty much compartmentalizes all of them into marriage, and that's it. Nothing else is allowed.
Well, you know, I always sort of applauded the communists for banning public display
of religion.
Yeah,
right.
I really did. And by the way, they've done that in France, too, now.
But the thing is, the thing I can't support about that is, you know, religion makes people so happy. They love the feeling of spiritual upliftment out of their misery.
Yeah, and then there's the victims of it. So, and the victims far outweigh today the niceties of all that.
You think the victims outweigh the,
yeah, well, absolutely,
the benefits?
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing I can say about the church, certainly the Catholic Church, not the other churches, because they haven't created much, but...
Well, the Protestant churches have created a lot.
Well, but they haven't created anywhere near the art that the Catholic Church...
Oh, no, no.
You know, they have vast wealth and in their art, and I applaud that. Michelangelo, I mean, all these...
Well, you know, when the Catholic Church was first developing, it really was very pagan. I mean, in a way, it still is kind of pagan. The whole idea of the one God is absurd because, first of all, there's a Father, a Son, and a Holy Ghost, and then there's, you know, all these saints, and it's you know, Mary has a lot of power in a way, and there's a certain paganism to it, and all the art, all the...
Well, they were great investors in art, and they were very pagan. And Borgia, the Borgia, and all those people, they were totally into art and sex, and you know, and fleecing the flock to live in grandeur.
Yeah, and they had to, I guess, because they kind of did away with slavery the way it was done in Roman times, and they made it into this other thing, serfs.
Mm-hmm.
And serfs were not technically slaves, but they were slaves. And so they had to create this whole religion that supported the idea that you have to kind of know your place and be meek. And that was not the pagan religion. That was the Christian religion, the idea that meekness is a virtue. The pagan religion didn't have meekness as a virtue. That was Christianity. That was a stroke of genius on the part of people in power. Figure they'll tell the great unsatisfied masses that, you know, you'll get to heaven if you're meek.
I always love that one.
Well, that, you know, who's Napoleon was the one who said that religion, the purpose of religion is to keep the poor from killing the rich.
Well, you know, absolutely. Why? Of course. You know, the meek shall inherit the earth. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, that I feel is one of the best quotes on religion I've ever heard.
What?
Napoleon's.
Yeah.
It's something like that. I don't think I have it exactly, but the purpose of religion is,
I mean,
to keep the poor from killing the rich.
If you listen to that.
From ransacking,
right,
the rich.
You know,
because they feel they have to be good. Because if they're not good, they'll go to hell. Nowadays, I don't know that they think they'll go to hell. I guess they just think they'll go to jail.
Well, it's a good thing that it's all collapsing and humanistic thought is really taking over. And, you know, if I believe in any superior force, I believe in the universe and all this.
And I do believe that what we're experiencing now with all the religious revivalism is a backlash against the progress that we are experiencing.
Of course.
Because we are, you know, we are fools, we humans, but at the same time, we are, in our foolish way, learning more and more about the universe and the science and the medicine.
And recreating ourselves.
Yeah.
Which is...
Playing God.
Yeah, playing God. And that's a very scary thing.
And then that totally separates sex from reproduction.
Right.
Then what's sex for? You can reproduce yourself without sex. You're practically getting to the point where you can reproduce yourself without sex.
And without pain of
it. It's going to be
a
fetish to reproduce with sex.
Yeah. But it also will be wonderful because you'll only have sex for pleasure.
Of course. It's
rather
wonderful.
Than pollution. All right.
Yep. Okay. So, I wonder what religion will have to say about sex at that point.
Well, they don't have much to say anymore. You know, I'm not as kind as you are. I think these people are fascists.
I am very kind. It's true. Yeah. I am much kinder than you. You're a meanie.
I have no tolerance for religious hacks and exploiters and oppressors of the poor.
Huh. Well, you know, I'm a student of comparative religion, and it does
anyway.
All interest me.
No, it interests
me too. I don't see it in a black and white way that all religion is bad.
No, I just said the Catholic Church did wonderful works of art.
Right.
You know, the other religions some of the Asian Eastern religions have created masterpieces. The modern religious, the new wave, has stunky churches. Even the Muslims still create beautiful churches, but the born again, you know, they're in storefronts.
Yeah.
You know, ugly storefronts. Here, God, I've opened a temple for you.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I have a Cadillac, God. You know, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no accounting for taste. But there is a kind of a goddess culture comeback also going on, you know. More sex positive, more body positive, more into the real than the ideal. And, you know, there's a lot of these women that are in the sexuality field.
I'm all for
that are reclaiming their goddess nature.
I'm all for every goddess that walks the earth. So I have
you know, and the whole Da Vinci Code thing is...
Yeah.
It's a big, big movement of goddess creeping back into spirituality.
Well, I think that's a growing movement.
It is.
You know, that women are starting to see themselves as goddesses. They're creators. They can create human life.
Hey.
Right?
Well... Some of us child-free people don't give a damn.
And those are more responsible goddesses. All right.
Okay, so, are we done?
We're done.
All right.
And
more on sex and God and Valentine's Day coming up in the next few days. In the meantime, be good, be happy. Try not to hurt anyone, including yourself. Make like the bonobos, not the baboons. That's my religion, the bonobo way. Make love to someone you love tonight, even if that someone is you. I love you.
You've been listening to Dr. Susan Block at Radio Susie 1, and you can find us 24 hours a day in the archives or in the live streaming videos at drsusanblock.com. That's drsusanblock.com. drsusanblock.com. From our house to your house, thank you so much for having us. Sorry we didn't hear from you. We always love to hear from you. And hopefully tomorrow night you'll want to talk to us. We're going to be talking about spirituality and sex and God and all of those strange concepts until 6 weeks at Yale. In the meantime, what I'm going to do, if you care to listen, sit back and relax. I'm going to play you a pre-recorded show. I know a lot of you enjoy listening and sitting back. And or, you know, it's the age of the internet, and you can go to many wonderful places. From my house to your house, thank you for having us. Peace on earth.
Right here, actually.